Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Basketball News Podcast Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. How are you, sir?
Doing well, doing great. Excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for embracing your bounce. I am pumped up.
This is going to be a fun episode. I feel it in my bones. We have a guest with us. We have the one, the only legendary Caitlin Cooper of Indy Cornrows, part of the SB Nation Network. How are you, ma'am?
I'm doing well. I feel like this is one of the most intimidating podcasts I've done. Like, I really have to step up my intelligence and knowledge here and pretend like I know what I'm talking about.
Aww. We are not doing fake humility on this podcast.
I promise you, you don't. I will just say like 7 to 10 bad puns. You'll be good. Don't worry about it.
That's actually a weak point for me, too. Like, I'm going to have pun on here. I'm going to have funny remarks.
We will throw you the lob. It's going to be fun. So, Caitlin, for the people who may not be familiar with you and your work, can you give the people a brief introduction?
Right. So, like you said, I'm over at Indy Cornrows, and I did do a freelance piece over the summer at 538. I do basically X's and O's stuff, or I attempt to, covering the Pacers. And like I told you before I come on, I'm born and raised in Indiana. I was around coaching when I was growing up. My dad coached high school basketball and I played. So that's kind of how I learned the game and just being around lots of coaches throughout the state and going around to different games and gyms. So
it's honestly, it's hard to get into hyperbole when describing your work. Like, I get smarter every time I read it or whenever I listen to you when you're on the pod. A good friend of mine, Mark Schindler, you two do great work together. It's genuinely a pleasure to have you on, and we picked a great time to have you on because the Indiana Pacers seem to be in a bit of flux. So let's dig right into them. They are 11-16 right now, good for 13th in the Eastern Conference. We just got a report from Sham Charania and also Bob Kravitz that the Pacers may be looking to blow things up, whatever blowing up means to them. What was your initial reaction when that news came down the pipeline?
Right. I don't know. Did you guys watch the game the Pacers played against the Heat here recently before that report came out? Yeah. Yeah. So there was just a little bit going on there. I mean, in between their like struggles against zone and their defensive lapses and some of their energy problems on defense, there was some frustration boiling over throughout the game. There was home fans booing. There was like not a lot of fans there, which is a part of the story that they reported, obviously, that there's a lot of fan apathy, which I've been able to tell on Twitter from people that, you know, just interact with me. So I wasn't entirely surprised by the timing of it, but I was surprised that ownership was willing to consider what they're terming as a rebuild, but I am not completely clear. It sounds a little bit more to me like it's a retool than a complete rebuild, but sounds like they don't really plan on tanking and going for a high draft pick, that if they did make moves, which Rick Carlisle and has gone on record, and I believe Kevin Pritchard has too, that they still believe in this current group, but that trades can happen. So take that for what you will. I mean, I think that's probably what you're going to say in this certain circumstances and players after last night's game. The vibes were a lot better, to use a cliche. Like, I thought that, you know, it seemed like players were, you know, celebrating each other's successes. There was better energy from the bench during the game. And the ball was moving more to the places where it needed to go, where during that win streak, I mean, that losing streak where they lost four games, I felt like it was going everywhere, but the very obvious place that it needed to be. So like, I mean, when you watch that Heat game, they were doing so well, just getting it to the middle of the floor and scoring from there. That was like the only time they scored against the zone. And yet at times they weren't looking for that. And then, you know, Miles might set a flare screen and it's like, no, we're not going to look for Duarte before that flare screen. Let's just throw it over here. You know, that kind of stuff. So, they've looked disorganized at times as a group, and that's a part of it too. But yeah, it's Pacers doing Pacer things. It's kind of like the weather. If you don't like how they look today, wait a couple days and they might look completely differently, because that's what's happened against the Wizards and last night whenever they played the Knicks. So both those teams are kind of struggling too, and they were on the second night of back-to-backs. But I thought process-wise, the Pacers did some of the things that they needed to do that they hadn't been doing in the four-game losing streak.
Gotcha. Steve, what was your reaction when you saw that the Pacers were willing to move some of their bigger names, bigger salaries?
A part of me said they looked in the mirror and saw it was time. The main thing I was surprised that Sabonis and Turner were both available. I thought they would choose one or the other. You know, I thought definitively kind of like a Nurkic-Jokic situation where they say, hey, this is our guy, this one's available. I thought we would get one or the other. And they said, hey, you can get whatever you want. If you get some for the right price, they're both here. So that part caught me by surprise. But the Pacers have been a weird team all season because you look at Brogdon, LeVert, Sabonis, Turner, plus Rick Carlisle should equal something. And it's just been a whole bunch of, wait, what's happening? Between just pace, tempo. Are we going to play half court and run sets? Or are we going to play random? Are we going to give the defensive effort? Are we going to have these one possession losses? And that's why I'm glad that Caitlin is here, because as always, I'm going to ask the question, what is this team? And I'm sure she's tired of answering that, but honest to God, this team should be better. And I don't get it.
See, that's what I thought going into the season as well. And like, typically, like, just to reveal myself, I'm typically not like a super optimistic person. And this was like the one time where I felt like, hey, you know, after the Bjorkgren situation and everything that went on behind the scenes and how many, you know, nights I spent playing the game, what type of defense are the Pacers even trying to play last season? I felt like, you know, they were a top six defense under Nate McMillan. So if you can go back to playing a scheme that just makes sense for this group, which they were able to do. I mean, Victor missed most of that season. Jeremy Lamb was the starting two. It felt like, you know, get the defense right. We know that Rick Carlisle can coach offense. It felt to me that they could potentially be like a low playoff team or at least back in the play-in tournament. And I think that the injuries do matter. I think they got off to a tough start before the season even started. Obviously, Caris LeVert had the back fracture and TJ Warren. His foot was hurting, or I mean, healing more slowly than they expected. And then there's also just been like nagging stuff like Duarte's shoulder bothering him and Caris not looking quite right once he got back. And then Brogdon missed some time. So like, I mean, still to this day, their starting lineup has not played a minute of basketball together that they've intended to see. So that's clearly not ideal. But what you said was a good description, because when they were on the 3-game losing streak prior to this 4-game one, they played the Knicks, the Pistons, and the Hornets. So they're in the fourth quarter against the Knicks, and the Knicks are really extending their ball pressure with Alec Burks. And you can see that every time they're looking over to the bench for a play call, and they're telling them at times, like in Detroit, you could hear audibly, like, hold the ball, hold it after a defensive rebound. And when that game's over, Rick Carlisle was kind of like, hey, we need to be the type of team where defense keys our offense. And, you know, our defense wasn't good enough. And yet, like, you didn't crack 90 points in two straight games. And Caris LeVert after that game was kind of like, you know, we can talk about defense all we want, but we didn't crack 90 points in two straight games. And it was a lot of play calling. So then they go to the Charlotte game and the starters get benched by the second half because of effort and other stuff. So then when they came back home, the coaching staff was like, hey, we're going to relax some of that. We're going to try to do less play calling. And that worked. And they looked good playing, admittedly, the Pelicans. And then they play the Bulls. And it's like, hey, they're playing zone. And this zone actually makes sense. Like the rotations are good. They're triggering man out of the zone, which is, you know, comparison to what the zone looked like last year, it seemed like progress was being made. And then they go into the 4-game losing streak, and obviously they're playing teams like Milwaukee, where it's like, you know, they just don't match up well with that type of a team. And then you see the roster limitations at times. But when you're in the clutch moments, I mean, that's where a lot of the losses have come. I believe they're 2-8 games that have actually been decided by 5 points or less. And when teams start ratcheting up the pressure against Brogdon or LeVert, and then they're having to make plays 4-on-3. There's been a lot of, I guess I would say, hinkiness. They've had trouble hitting the roll man out of that. And it's a little bit confusing to me, which goes back to Sabonis's whole role of, like, you know, a lot of times he's just used so much as a screener for them to, you know, reject or go away from picks or to run veer or whatever it is, rather than getting him in the middle of the floor so that you can create inside out threes. Or using their size and actually, like, again, I'm not Shaq. I'm not on TNT saying post him every time. But, like, it's a little bit confusing to me that he's averaging fewer post-ups than Porzingis did in Dallas last year when Rick Carlisle was the coach. So I don't think that they use that fully. But when they did come back, because the weather does constantly change, when they played the Wizards, they had more role man possessions in that game than the four prior. And Sabonis had more post-ups combined than the three prior games. So it looked like, hey, we worked on finding the pocket pass. Our guards did this, but they also weren't facing the same type of pressure. And then last night in the game, I felt like they did a really good job defensively extending their pressure to, you know, return the favor against the Knicks. And then also, like I said, the ball was just moving with a lot more purpose. But the question is, what does that mean against two teams that have been struggling themselves? And does it really change my opinion of their ceiling? Probably not.
That's fair. I think that's... The Pacers have also confused me. I think that's the consensus between us three. I think what's really thrown me off has been the usage of Sabonis this year. Like, it has been a lot of, and this is something that you've written about, a lot of him in the corner, which has been weird. And there seems to be a noticeable difference in the half court attack when he's used as a screener and actually gets the roll and actually gets those touches in the middle versus him just kind of being used as a decoy. And it's been like, how surprised are you by, I guess, just by Rick Carlisle's philosophy this year? Like, what were your expectations coming in versus what you've seen so far?
Right. I mean, it kind of feels like they're always kind of combating the wrong problem, because like I said, after Nate Bjorken completely remade a defense that was already working, I don't think I would have identified last year's problems as like Sabonis is a fulcrum and that needs to change. But it feels like that is in part what they have done. Like, I'm not saying he doesn't do it at all. And some of it is a product of like, they haven't been good shooting the 3-point, you know, threes as a team. So players will come off of, you know, a TJ McConnell or a Torrey Craig. So he's seeing more bodies in the paint. And some teams just naturally crowd him because he has that degree of roll gravity. So he's not necessarily going to be catching the ball in all of those situations. Or if he does, it may not lead to a shot for him, which is why he might not have, you know, tons of shots every game. But at the same time, it's like, I always look at Miles and Sabonis and ask myself through the lens of like, is there a reason for why you're doing this? Like, why either one of them is involved? And like this morning, obviously, this newest report from Jared Weiss at The Athletic, where Miles is on record saying, you know, I'm a glorified role player, essentially saying he's dissatisfied with his role and he wants more. And I'm sympathetic to that to an extent, because I do think he's improved at things this year. Like, he's finding spots to duck in much better than he was 2 years ago. He's shooting the three considerably better than last year. And if people do come out, he'll take like a one dribble three. He'll let the ball go. Like, even if, you know, even if his guy comes off and then a small rotates over to him, he'll still shoot over the top. Better on the glass for offensive rebounds. But to me, it's like, what is the point in certain circumstances for you to be the ball screener and Sabonis to be off ball? Like, why do I want somebody who's a worse screener to be doing that when Sabonis's guy is going to roam off into the lane anyways? So then, like, an example I would give, like, it makes sense to me to make Miles the screener late when they played the Lakers. The Lakers went centerless. LeBron was at the five. For whatever reason, they decided they didn't want to try to have Sabonis challenge LeBron. So let's involve Miles as the screener. Carmelo Anthony's guarding him. We can get him in space. Like, that makes sense. Well, then they trapped Brogdon and Miles didn't really handle some of those passes 4-on-3. And Sabonis's guy's coming all the way over and like stripping Miles. So it's like, you know, it just feels a little bit mismatched. Like, why is this a thing that I'm watching in certain circumstances? I'm fine with it when there's a like actual basketball reason where you're going to get an advantage for it. But it can also feel like, you know, why are you just doing this? Because last night it was clear that like, they probably knew that article was coming out. I mean, they were quoted in it. And the very first set of the game was a set for Miles that was Horn's twist with him coming off an exit screen. Great. Like, if you can shoot off a screen, tremendous. That changes your spacing. But like, to me, his best moments last night were still when he's like this floor spacing, cutting, big, who can also put the ball on the floor. Not so much when he's actually involved in the screening action. I think they have tried to tinker with his footwork a little bit. So like, he can use a hop step and be getting hopefully a little bit more separation, similar to what Sabonis does. And maybe with more reps, it improves. I think there's value of diversity and interchangeability of play, but I don't think you just need to do it to do it.
Understood. Steve, where have you been at on the front court usage this year?
It's been a weird deal, but Sabonis Turner has been a weird combination this entire time. I feel like it's looked as consistent as it can over the last few years. I think part of the issue with the Sabonis role feels like at times Carlisle kind of made a decision like, okay, this is what we're going to do. Miles, you're going to do X. Sabonis, you're going to do Y. And we're going to roll with that. And it doesn't necessarily jive with either of them, because the problem is both of them are great as the five, as the screener, as the roller. And we know Sabonis can also add the handoff game, add the post game in your possessions. And the problem is Turner doesn't necessarily have that secondary thing right now, like DeMontis does. So if he's not getting anything out of pick and roll, he's purely going to be the spacer. And as far as some of the comments he made, it sounds more to me like someone who just wants the chance to do more rather than be told what he can do. Because what he's asked to do is probably what you should ask him to do, especially in this scenario. Play defense, space the floor. We'll get you some screen and roll, some handoffs, but you know, you're not going to be the guy right now. So for him to feel like he's a glorified role player, it doesn't necessarily feel like a Dwight Howard, I need the ball more type deal. It kind of just feels like I'm good at this.
Yeah.
And I need to do this more, but it doesn't fit what they're doing here. So it's just like kind of a head clashing deal where I think they've gotten as much out of it as they can, but it's going to be a push and pull because they're both so good when they're by themselves.
Right. And that's a good point, because I think it's more about him saying like, I want to play, you know, have more opportunities at the five, and I want to be able to play within the action, not so much off of it. And it's like what, you know, the dynamic that you just explained and that I did as well. It's like, it doesn't always make sense with both of them out there at the same time. And, you know, like I said, they tried to do some of it last night. We'll see maybe if he has more reps, but it doesn't necessarily seem like you can accomplish both of those things at once consistently. And it almost feels like you're playing a little bit of a risky game trying to. I mean, after the game last night, they both said like, we want to play here, we want to be here. Maybe if you have buy-in, and I'm not saying that they don't, but you know, for that to be quoted on the record and to say it, you clearly are wanting more than what you currently have.
Mm-hmm. I guess, what does more look like for Miles specifically? Like, do you trust him to run more handoffs in particular? Do you trust him more as a guy that can like fake it and get downhill? Because there has been some growth over the last year and a half or so with him putting the ball on the floor.
Right. He's been better, I think, like as a driver and attacking closeouts. I've seen growth there because he actually does, I won't say seek contact, but he doesn't avoid it. Like, he goes into guys. With the handoffs and the other stuff, early in preseason, they were running like delay pretty much nonstop because they didn't have their full playbook in. So whoever the first big back was spreading to the corner, and the trailer was then going into handoffs. And some of that was a little bit dicey. Like, one example I would give is that Sabonis, particularly with Doug McDermott, and now he's doing it more with Chris Duarte. Like, if teams are overplaying that, he will literally leave the ball live and use just a dribble, like not actually handing it off for that guy to zoom into it so that they're automatically running into contact. Whereas a lot of times with Miles, it can become a little bit like hot potato-like, where it's like, I want to pitch this ahead and get rid of it, and before I've even made contact on the screen. So I don't think that there's always quite as much optionality. I mean, I don't know that I would trust him in 4-on-3 situations, and this is a piece of it, because he's been a very high efficiency player this year on low usage. And I wonder if that isn't really his best role. Like, and I'm not him, I don't know what his desires and his wants are. Clearly he wants more than that, but teams don't guard him the same way as Sabonis. So if he does show improvement, what happens when teams aren't guarding pick and rolls 2-on-2 anymore? Or if he does draw an extra person, is he going to be able to make plays out of that? Like, I think I would say of their strengths, like if I were to tell you, and that's what's so funny about them, they're so polar opposite. If I were to say what's the best thing about Sabonis, I would say read and react. If I were also to say like what's Miles's weakest point, I would probably say read and react. I think he has improved at it. I just don't think, you know, when you have one in the light of day of the other, it's kind of like when I watched Sabonis's defense. He's also improved as a defender this year, but he's not Miles, like at the rim. So it shows up.
It's a weird deal because they complement each other because they have opposite skill sets, but they also don't work together.
And they also need to play the same position.
Exactly. Because one thing I noticed when they played the Knicks, Miles had super juice when he was playing the start of the second quarter. Whenever he's playing at the five, he looks different. And the one thing with Miles is I wish he was a better screener, because it would make a lot of what he wants to do make more sense. But at the same time, if he's not going to get a lot of contact, it's not a consistent role. Sometimes it's a pop, sometimes it's not, maybe to the three, to the mid-range. It's like, well, why will we do more of that? But then it works when he plays with the bench. So it's like, it's this weird yin-yang type deal.
Yeah, the screening element's interesting, because like down the stretch when they played the Sixers, and don't ask me why the Sixers were going over on every TJ McConnell screen, like that's for them to decide, but they were doing it, and they pretty much cooked the Sixers with the same play three times in a row, with TJ coming off a double drag and then Sabonis doing a Gortat like seal screen on Andre Drummond. And like, I was thinking in my head, I'm like, yeah, that's not something you would probably want Miles to do. And I do wonder, because like I said, I could tell a difference in his footwork. And like you said, like it was, he wanted to get out of those screens really quick, because if I get out of it quicker, I have a better chance to get the ball on the roll. And in so doing, he was making no contact on any of the picks. So I think that's probably, you know, some push and pull, whereas with Sabonis, like he just has a lot of subtle, you know, techniques where he knows when he needs to release to create room for a person, you know, split or drive, or he needs to flip the angle, or, you know, whatever that's going to be. And sometimes Miles is better at that than others, but that will be something to continue to watch if they're going to keep trying to get him more picks in the flow game that they're trying to play.
The third name that was mentioned in that Sham / Bob Kravitz report was Caris LeVert, who has had an uneven tenure in Indiana, I think is the polite way to say it. Before even playing a game, he had the health issue. And this season, it hasn't looked very good by my eye. What have you seen from Caris this year? What do you project for him moving forward?
Yeah, so Caris towards the back end of last season when Malcolm Brogdon was out, I believe with a hamstring injury, and Miles was out with the turf toe, like when the defense was a mess. But they were playing two-man game, and they were developing good pick-and-roll chemistry between the two of them, with Caris having more opportunities to be on ball. And now when he came back, I do think that his back has been limiting to him to an extent, because you'll see little parts where it's like, oh, I can't just get another step, or I can't quite shift gears, whether it's in transition or, you know, trying to slice through a zone or whatever he's doing. Here these last couple of games, I do think he's looked better. But yeah, I mean, he went through a stretch where he had one of the worst effective field goal percentages. His assist rate was, I mean, it's dropped off. His assisted usage rate's dropped off on cleaning the glass by like 85th to in the 50s. And there's just spots where it's like he doesn't want to make a pass. Like, I know that he's capable of doing it because I watched him do it in the bubble when he played for the Nets. And I watched him do it last season when he was getting like blitzed against the Heat, for instance. And now this year, it's like sometimes like the very obvious pass that he needs to make, it's almost like he has blinders. But again, and trending pacer wise, I do think he was better about that against the Wizards and finding the right spots where he needed to move the ball. Otherwise, his shot profile is limiting, because he wants to take those little like 6 foot push shots. And if you're not getting all the way to the rim, then, you know, what are you doing on nights when those shots don't fall? And sometimes he's better at drawing contact on that than others, but he's not shooting the three well. And that's kind of the dynamic, just like what we said with Turner and Sabonis, is it's almost more underrated that people don't talk about the dynamic between Brogdon and LeVert, because LeVert needs to have the ball and Brogdon wants to run offense. And quite frankly, it's just been better than LeVert this season. And Brogdon is a better off-ball shooter, but then sometimes you're watching possessions where LeVert, and it's like, okay, if you're running offense, what's that doing for anybody else on the team? Like, it's just boom or bust whether you make a shot. So sometimes you wonder when you watch him, like, if they were to move him, I do think he could be helpful for a team that would need, like, a really good sixth man who needs to be a bench creator, because he kind of needs to be in that role where, like, he needs, like, star-level touches and handling of the ball, but he can't consistently produce at that as a starter. But I do think he started to look a little bit better in these two most recent contests, but we'll see if that carries over.
It's just been a funkier fit than I thought. I think, especially with the changes that have gone on with the offense this year, like, it seems like they've needed some sort of injection of flow into their attack. And Caris is very much I'm going to slow it down. I'm going to ISO you up. I'm going to get to my spots and take a contested shot. And when he has it going, like we've seen it when he was in Brooklyn, like when he has it going, he can take over for quarters at a time. But that's it just kind of doesn't vibe with what Indiana's trying to do. And compare, you know, already with the front court kind of being, I don't want to say misused, but it's been interesting usage there. The spacing issues that you talked about, they haven't shot well from three this year. You put Caris on the ball, like you would think he's probably, you know, outside of Sabonis, he's probably the worst shooter in the starting lineup when he's out there with that the core. So you want him to have that usage to kind of mitigate that. But if he's not making the passes available to him, then it's kind of a double whammy there. So it's been a weird watch for me when I've seen Caris this year. Steve, how have you felt about Caris this season?
It's been very interesting. And it's funny, when you first asked the question about the rumors and the trades, I wondered how much of it was just LeVert in Indiana looking for a better bridge guy. You know, if you go from PG to Oladipo and Sabonis, and then you go to LeVert, that might not be the bridge to the next steps. They might need something better. I like that y'all mentioned the weird fit, because Caris is good on ball, and we've seen the flashes of playmaking and scoring. But it just does not feel like he's getting in the flow, and the usage isn't quite as there. Now, I don't know if he's as healthy as he could be, but it just feels like every pick and roll is a drop, two dribbles. I'm right there. The defense is there, and I got to kick. But the reads just aren't there. I don't know if it's the spacing. I don't know if it's the pick and roll actions. I'm not sure what it is, but it doesn't feel like he's making the leap that you thought he might make. And then when you add Brogdon to the mix and what he does on ball and how he creates, And maybe Karras isn't getting as many touches or is getting as many looks as you might think he should or could, or getting in a rhythm. It's just kind of boom or bust, as Caitlin said, where I'm either scoring or I'm just going to pass because I can't score. Like, a lot of his actions feel like passes his second thought. And the problem is Indiana needs him to be the Karras LeVert, like the best version, you know, where he can score, he can play make, he's making the right reads. And we just haven't quite seen that. And so I wonder, to me, how much of this whole thing is just, we just need someone better, which is, you know, unfortunate, because I loved them getting him in that deal, because I thought with his talent, he would fit right in. But it's just, it's been off. Like, something's just been off. That leap hasn't quite been the same. And of course, the health issues haven't helped him, but you would expect to see more when you have at least two pick and roll partners, you know. But the flow and the rhythm just hasn't made sense. He's either a guy that needs the ball in his hands a lot, or he needs to be in an offense where the ball is popping and moving and he knows he's going to get another opportunity so he can attack closeouts or get the second pick and roll attack when the defense moves. It feels like the yin-yang they've had this year has kind of held him back a little bit.
Yeah, and the interesting thing too is that in some respects, with like the, when they are in set, some of the stuff that Carlisle runs fits Duarte at the two better. Like, you know, getting him, you can use him, like, you know, in motion strong. And then if they do top block him, he can go straight into Spain and he's the back screener. And then maybe that actually puts some tension in a way that it's not going to be for Karras. Or if they run 1-4 flat and Duarte can be the go screener and slip out, you know, that makes a little bit more sense. But then it goes back to the Brogdon thing that, like, if you see those two, then like, hey, we think we can move Karras, Duarte will be the starter. Then Brogdon's carrying a lot of handling load, because I think Duarte can do some of that. I don't know if I feel really good about him doing a lot of it. I mean, it's certainly not as a primary. I mean, he can do some of it coming off of, like, you know, a stagger where he's a secondary playmaker. I think he's shown some flashes there, but he's not the most accurate passer all the time. So then it becomes, and what I mentioned earlier with like some of the press that they've seen with Brogdon is like, I'm not sure they have somebody that has like the right burst handle combination to really combat some of that. Like, Brogdon's a really good driver, but if he's getting slowed up in the court, or if people like duck under a pick against him, he doesn't really have the ability to create space for like a three really well for himself. His release is slower versus, you know, Karras does have the ability to create space for himself, but then he's not the most effective shooter. So it's just kind of an odd dynamic at times.
Understood. Let's go to Brogdon very quickly, because we talked about him in relation to LeVert and specifically him being a better, you know, lead initiator with the offense. How do you feel about Brogdon as an initiator overall? Because I think if they shift to a full-blown rebuild, like, do you think he's someone that has staying power in Indiana, or would you look to move him like this offseason or moving forward?
Right. Yeah. Since he can't be moved this season, I mean, I think you probably evaluate everything, but the one thing about Brogdon is no matter what direction you go with like the Turner Sabonis thing, I think he's going to fit either way. Like, he's a pretty easy guy to fit into about anything you want to do. But then it becomes, you know, does he have to continue to be the primary? Because he has worked, I mean, they mentioned that they worked on how to be better at finding pocket passes because they've had this weird allergy to finding roll men. But like an example, like, he comes down the floor against the Lakers. So Sabonis is probably like 2 feet from him with a guy behind him. Duarte's in the corner and Brogdon needs to throw a whip pass, or he like doesn't want to give it just to Sabonis in front of him. So he's going to hit Duarte in the corner and it goes like 3 feet in the air over the top of his head. Like, Brogdon can do it. It's just like, he's not, you know, I don't really know how to term it. Like, I don't want to call him not. He's not a top tier elite point guard. I'll just put it that way. Like, they like the rest of the Pacers, they have a lot of good players. Like, he's good. He does a lot of valuable things for them. And it's also like defending his own position. Like, they're more willing to switch up, you know, and cross match guys. But part of the problem is like, if you need Brogdon to guard a smaller guard, that's not really his thing. Like, his point of attack defense still isn't great. Like, he's good if he can guard bigger wings. I mean, they've even tried him out, like, you know, they tried him on Giannis, they tried him on Karl Anthony Towns and trying to double in that regard. And, you know, that was a little bit mixed, but he's better guarding wings than he is guards. So it has to be the right kind of combination of what people you have out there. And that's why defensively Duarte does make some more sense. Cause like when they played the Hawks, Duarte was pretty much face guarding Trae Young during the fourth quarter and was doing pretty decently at it. So it's just amount of how much you trust Brogdon to continue to be in that primary role. And I've had some questions about that this year, because I also questioned just like his overall durability, that when you're asking him to do this much with the amount of injuries that he's had, it seems like he starts to wear down as the seasons have gone over the last 2 years, because he's having to do so much handling by comparison to what maybe he would do if they had more people that could do that.
It just feels like he profiles better as like a guy that can play off of a real playmaking wing, if that makes sense. Or if they go back to like fully playing through Sabonis, like he has the shooting ability, he can get downhill off of those handoffs. Like it feels like he's better at playing off someone as far more so than actually initiating the action, being responsible for all of that. Because I do think at a certain point he is kind of stretched thin in that role. And I mean, it's stretched in for him, but also for a team that desperately needs as much spacing as they can get, like having him on ball all the time, like he's improved as a pull-up shooter over the last couple of years, but that's something that he's had to grow into throughout his career. So I'm just curious to see like what all of this means for him moving forward. Steve, how have you felt about Brogdon this year?
I felt like he's been pretty good, but again, he's Malcolm Brogdon. And it feels like he's having to do a lot of things on ball and having to create a lot of things for them. And it just feels like Indiana's kind of chosen him as a part of the piece for now. And maybe they chose him to go forward with because he can fit with a lot of people. But to me, it feels like he kind of has to be, this is going to sound disrespectful, but the third best player in a sense, where he's filling in the gaps, he's making shots, he can create on ball, but he doesn't have to make every play for you. And where if you get either playing through Sabonis or you get that wing, now he can kind of fill that role. Now he becomes more dangerous. But if it's just kind of him or Brad Wanamaker.
Brad Wanamaker stray on the pod.
A couple of them. But it just becomes difficult. And now it's more like, okay, if you put him off ball, who's running the action on ball? And is his spacing going to have the same impact? Because, you know, is he going to get the ball back? You know, is his man going to help off? So I've liked what he's done. It's no disrespect. I think he's had a pretty good year.
Yeah.
But at the same time, none of this is really his fault, but I don't know what he does to improve it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think that's why some of it shows up at times during clutch time, which, I mean, when they played the Wizards, and again, take the caveats that I don't think they put forth their necessarily most impressive performance. They did try to use like more ram screens and stuff to slow down some of those traps so that he wasn't facing quite as much pressure. But it's kind of like, you know, the whole roster. Like ideally you would have balance amongst all five guys and they'll continue to grow in this, you know, random flow game that they're trying to do that's less predictable as the season goes on that teams aren't going to be able to gear up against. But do they have people that are going to be able to counter exaggerated coverages if they were to get into a playoff series? I don't know that I'm super convinced of that. Like, I think, you know, Rick Carlisle is obviously very good at making adjustments in games, and that would be an advantage over perhaps what they've had in the past. But I can't say that I'm super convinced, which is why I'm not all the way surprised that some of these reports came out this week.
Makes sense. Just to sum up a little bit. Oh, go ahead, Steve.
Well, I was going to say that's part of my thing, because I feel like if the Pacers are running a little bit more of the flow, a little bit more of the random play, we'd see a little bit more different version of Brogdon. But when it comes down to half court, run a play, that's where I'm not as certain that I like it as much. Not what he's doing, but I just feel like there's meat left on the bone.
Makes sense. So going back to, I guess, just the trade discussion overall, like, if you're Indiana, what player archetype are you looking for if you're flipping a Turner or a LeVert or a Sabonis? Are you looking for that lead guard to kind of take some pressure off of Brogdon in that regard? Or
they're looking for CJ McCollum, obviously. That was for Caitlin.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't understand. Like, we can talk about that because I don't understand why that's being brought up for either team. Like, if you're the Portland Trailblazers and you have the worst defense in the NBA, and like, again, I'm not trying to be reductive about Sabonis. I do think that he's made some improvements on defense this year. But if you're trying to fix your defense, why wouldn't you go after the other Pacer center? Like, that seems kind of, you know, obvious to me, other than like, if you're just really into nostalgia, or if you think that like, you're going to have to move Dame and it's like, oh, everybody loved Arvidas Sabonis, we could get Sabonis. Like, I don't really get that. And then, like, on the CJ McCollum front, I like CJ. He's probably better than, you know, LeVert, clearly, for what LeVert's been this season. But it's like, you would need more playmaking if you're getting rid of Sabonis, and you would have less, like, to a certain degree. Like, and he's not somebody who's really going to get to the free throw line, which has been a, you know, an ongoing problem for the Pacers too. So I don't really understand that for either side. But yeah, I mean, it would depend on, I don't fully get what they want to do right now completely. I mean, it sounds like they just want to retool. So in that respect, I'm not exactly sure why Sabonis's name is kind of out there, because he's the one who has more years left on his contract. And to me, like, he's only making $18 million a year. So with more years left, I feel like you could move a couple other pieces, see how his defense looks with the pieces that you get back. If it's a complete disaster, then you could move on from him in a year after you've actually seen what he can do with a team that's actually more crafted. I mean, I'm not saying completely build around him, because I still think you would need like a top option, but makes more sense for him. If you're going to fully rebuild, then I think you're just calling teams and being like, hey, who's going to give us, which one of these two centers is going to get a better package? If Sabonis is going to get better stuff, then we'll continue with Miles and move on in that direction. But if it's Miles, then you just pick in that regard. But I think that the visions look a little bit different. Obviously, if you're keeping Miles and Sabonis is gone and you still have Brogdon, then yeah, I think you would probably be looking at a point guard who can be doing a lot of playmaking and be moving Brogdon off ball and supplement for what you're losing. If it's Sabonis, you'd have to find ways to make up for some of the defense. So, you know, maybe it depends somewhat what Ajax does. You might want to add a weak side rim protector, but I think ideally like a wing who could shoot off of motion, but also get his own shot, so that you could have more of a top option if stuff's, you know, slowed down in the half court, and have something else in addition to somebody who could play off of him and do both of those things. So that's kind of what I would be looking at if I was looking at, I still want to be competitive right now.
This obviously isn't a wing that can shoot off of movement, but there was a lot of smoke around the Ben Simmons stuff, at least until Malcolm Brogdon got his extension. Like, how did you feel about the idea of Ben Simmons in Indiana?
This is like the triumvirate of terrible topics. What are your thoughts on Turner versus Sabonis? What are fake trades? And what are your opinions on Ben Simmons? Like, in part, I'm really struggling because of how they've used Sabonis, how Ben Simmons would have fit.
Yeah.
Like, in this current system, like, what were you planning to have him do alongside Miles Turner? Is he going to stand in the corner? Like, I mean, to an extent, I mean, defensively, you can see clear upgrades there. They don't have anybody that can do some of the stuff that, well, pretty much any of the stuff that Ben can do defensively. But I feel like with Ben, you're going to need to run a lot of stuck pick and roll. And I know that there'd be a lot of pushback because Sabonis and Ben both, you know, nobody's going to guard them outside the free throw line. But I do think that they're both very smart playmakers and could make some of that work. And if you need a physical screener, I could see it. But I think that you're taking back a lot of money there. And then it's Ben Simmons. Like, is he a 16 game player? Is he a guy that's going to come in and like you're a fourth or a fifth seed? And then it's like the Pacers are kind of just circling back to what they were, but you know, they got this other new exciting piece. And I don't completely know how he feels about basketball. So I feel like that would be a pretty big risk. Like, I don't know where he currently is at in his journey with that type of stuff. So it would be somewhat controversial for me, I think, if they went ahead and did that.
Understood. Steve, did you want to hop in with Ben Simmons talk?
No, I did not.
Your favorite topic.
Did not want to talk about Ben Simmons. I think it's clear Indiana is trying to retool on the low. Like, they're calling it a rebuild, but I think they're trying to get a guy. They're trying to get someone. They're trying to get a piece, because where else are you going to get it? They can't go full rebuild. That city, that arena is going to be empty. And they can't get anyone in free agency. So I think when I saw Sabonis and Turner both available, I was like, ah, okay. They're trying to get another bridge, and they're trying to get a better bridge to the next step and try and figure it out from there. I don't know what it is. I don't think it's young pieces, but it could be. But I think they're clearly just trying to get a person, whether it's LeVert plus one should get them, I would imagine, a wing, maybe. But I don't even know who's available, because everyone's kind of still in it right now. So it's not like anyone's in panic mode, and not like anyone's looking for significant upgrades. They still believe in what they're doing. So it's kind of like a weird time for them to throw that out. Like, hey, these guys are available. And everyone's just like, I think we're okay. I think.
And even to that point about everyone kind of being in it, like I said at the top, like Indy's 13th in the East. I think they have a positive net differential right now. And they're not far out of the play-in tournament right now anyway. So I don't know. It does feel treadmillish to me with Indiana right now. They do have some, they have good pieces that don't fit great together. And so I guess I can see it from either side to where it's like, hey, let's just get some more time with this. Let's actually find our thing, because it's the biggest issue for me watching Indiana is that they don't seem to have a thing on either end of the floor right now. And it just kind of changes by quarter, by game. Yeah,
exactly.
So I think there is some upside to this squad if they actually find their things. Like Rick Carlisle is a very good head coach. Well, first and foremost, I hope he's okay. He's in health and safety protocols right now. So hopefully he's all right. But I mean, the track record is there. Like, he is a very good head coach, even if the start of the season has been weird for him. There are good players on this roster. And if they can get to whatever version of healthy the Pacers can be, because that's not a word that's really that really fits them over the past few years. But whatever semblance that is, like they can still be a play-in team, or they can still get to six. I feel like it's early enough to where they can make that push. But for me, it's like, what does that even mean? If they do get to six, what is this? Which seems to be the theme of this team this year.
Yeah, I mean, can you take another step forward beyond that, or is that just what the ceiling is? And at what point are you ready to move on from it? Because, I mean, TJ Warren, he would help them in a lot of ways, like clearly. And there are times where I think about, you know, what would this roster have looked like if you had the current version of Miles with Brogdon and Sabonis and with Victor Oladipo before his injury and with TJ Warren from the bubble? Like, I can kind of see the overall vision there. Like, that makes a lot of sense to me. So I get why they've kind of held on to it. And I don't think that they have to be in a rush. Like, they just have to sell these guys off unless, you know, they know more about what the locker room dynamic is than I do. But at the same time, it's like, you know, you have somebody on the record talking about their role and it's not really clear to see if you're going to be able to be better than what you just said. Like, even if you do get up to the sixth seed, you know, what then? But it's just awkward and it's hard to know, because part of me thinks, like, you know, maybe they find some momentum and they really can get better and that's okay for this particular season. But at what point is okay just not okay?
Let's dig into the rookie class really quickly. With Chris Dortuk, what has surprised you the most with him this season?
Right. So I don't think that I was completely ready to see his playmaking, which I know that I just brought up that it can be spotty, but he has done some of that here of late out of the pick and roll, where he seems to be finding pockets a little bit better. Not all the time. It's not completely consistent. I love his footwork. It's so good. Like, the Pacers don't have other guys that can shoot off of a hedge or off a switch and that type of degree. I think sometimes you can rely on it a little bit too much, where, like, maybe you don't need to take a step back moving to your left for a baseline two when you actually have space where you could go to the rim. But I think that they did really well at the draft spot that they were at, and that he fits what they want to do. I mean, it is kind of interesting in the sense that, you know, now that the word rebuild was brought up, that you did draft somebody that, like, is this ready-made player and what his age is. And, like, I don't want to harp on what his age is, because I don't really care outside of that particular context. But if you are, like, you're willing to move Turner or Sabonis because they're 25 and what they're going to get you back, like, in some respects, Chris Duarte is probably one of your best assets. He's only 24. He's on a rookie scale deal. Like, if you were really ready to go through a rebuild, there's going to be contenders that would want somebody like Chris Duarte because of his ability to shoot off the ball. He's an easy person to slide into about any team, and he does play defense at the other end of the floor. So it's a little bit surprising that it seems like he would be completely off the table. But I think he hit a little bit of a slide where it was kind of hard for him to find possessions where, and then he was forcing some stuff, which is why they took him out of the starting lineup after that Hornets game. And now he's been back in because Justin Holiday's in health and safety protocols. But and that Knicks game, I think you guys said that you watched it. I thought that his chemistry with Sabonis was really starting to look good there in the first quarter. And, you know, some of that's just like him completely eating Evan Fournier's lunch and, you know, that being a continuing trend. But like, he's doing better with, like, DHO counters where he can go and get a late pass or, you know, find spots and continue to develop that chemistry. So that's been good to see.
We talked about Duarte on the first rookie report. Have you seen anything differently since last time we talked about him?
I mean, he's consistently bringing what he does well every night to the table as far as being able to score. You know, he can shoot. He can play defense. He's not a liability on that end, which is good for a young player. I have been happy to kind of see him be able to maintain some of the aggression, even if it's a little bit more contained than it was earlier in the year. You know, as they've gotten healthier, he hasn't necessarily looked like, fish out of water completely. So I think he's good, and I think he's only going to progress, and now it's just going to be how much time is he going to get, you know, and how much opportunities is he going to get, because he's a guy who can help your second unit. He can slide in, put starters if you need. You just wonder how it looks long term, but that's just me with the Pacers right now because I'm not sure what I'm going to see every single night.
This is very true. Like I think for me, like I'm with Caitlin. I did not expect the playmaking either. I think zooming out, I just didn't expect them to lean on him as much as they have with creation, because once they made the pick and then you see where, you know, Doug McDermott leaves, it's like, okay, cool. Like, not to pigeonhole him, but he's going to be the McDermott replacement in theory as a guy that can shoot off movement and can spot up Phillip lanes and transition, things of that nature. But then he shows some, you know, in summer league in particular, like he showed a lot of pick and roll creation. I was like, oh, wait, he has a lot more juice than I thought. And I'm not a draft Nick, so like I was probably going to be surprised by that anyway. But I was like, okay, he has a little bit more on the ball than I thought he did. And then the beginning of the season happens, and like I go back to the Indiana-Miami game in which the Heat just did not have an answer for him late in that game. And he's just sprinkling in pull-up jumpers whenever he wanted to. It was like, okay, well, if this is what Chris Duarte can do, like Indiana might, not saying he's a star-level prospect, but like Indiana has something that I didn't expect them to have. And so actually, I'll flip it to you. Do you feel like he's been better than what McDermott has done in San Antonio this year?
Yeah, I haven't seen a ton of Doug there. It feels like some of the games that I've seen, he was out with like knee injuries and this or that. I mean, clearly you're not having to pay into the luxury tax for Chris Duarte, which would have been the case with Doug. And I do think that because of that, yeah, Chris Duarte has more upside because, I mean, you're not going to use Doug McDermott on ball. I think that there's certain spots where you could probably have Chris do a little bit less than that. But if they're focused on like, you know, a dual philosophy of we want to continue to develop him to be able to do other things while we're trying to win games, that having him in the bench role sometimes does make sense, but then it pushes TJ McConnell off. And some of the TJ McConnell stuff has been a little bit weird. Like they'll play him in bench lineups with LeVert, and it's like, why do you have two bad shooters out there? And then it's like, you know, why is TJ McConnell just standing, you know, glued to the 3-point line in the corner where nobody's guarding him so that Duarte can run some of this? Like that dynamic's been a little bit awkward, but yeah, I mean, his, what you just said against the Heat, like his ability to step into like smooth pull-up transition jumpers is not an element that they would otherwise really have.
I'm glad you brought up TJ McConnell, because I thought coming into this that TJ McConnell plus Rick Carlisle would be gold after watching him play JJ Barea and Damon Harris for 15 years consecutively. And it hasn't been, and I've been disappointed by that. Just want to get that out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of weird. I mean, he had a stretch of games where he was back to like, I'm going to get to my spot until the world melts and like I can get wherever I want to go. And they unleashed him to be, you know, probing and doing more of like the TJ McConnell stuff. And then other times, like I said, he's been in closing lineups where, you know, they might want to play 2-3 zone. So they really want TJ out there to be up at the top pressuring because he's so good at doing that. And then it's like, then offensively, again, like, why is he like the shake and the pick and roll where nobody cares that he's out there and that person's just adding another body to Sabonis when you could be having him do that. And maybe you have Brogdon off ball doing as the better off ball shooter. So it's like I said, they want to do a lot of interchangeability and diversity of play. And it's like, okay, you don't necessarily have the roster that can always do that. Like not everybody on this roster can dribble, pass and shoot. So sometimes they just need to be a little bit more optimized in what it is that they actually do. And I think too, some of it's just like the difference between positioning and spacing. Like, I think you could probably have TJ McConnell throw the ball into the post and then go get a ball for a cut to the basket versus like TJ McConnell and Sabonis are both spaced out to the 3-point line and just standing there and no one cares. You know, it's those types of awkward dynamics at times with him.
And that speaks to the whole Pacers, honestly, because I feel like they're just missing the base, because it feels like Carlo has X, Y, and Z that he wants to do. The roster maybe can't do all of that. So then sometimes he's caught between let them play and let's run this that works. And it just hasn't really meshed. So that's why I just want to see them play. Like when they play with pace and tempo, they actually look like what they could. They have the talent, but then they just disappear for 4 to 5 games.
Or an entire third quarters or the last 5 minutes of games.
Oh, goodness. While we're on the bench, I was going to ask you about Isaiah Jackson, but I have another front court question for you. What's the deal with Goga?
The million-dollar question. Yeah, so Goga was actually playing for a brief stretch with Sabonis off the bench. So the two of them were being used in like a hedge scheme because they've been using Sabonis a lot more to be up, like being active rather than having him take so much action at the rim. And that wasn't really something they could have done last year. Like at the times when Nate Bjorken tried that, like in the one game against the Mavs when Miles Turner was out, like it was kind of a disaster. They had to move him off of Kristaps Porzingis and I believe put like Justin or somebody on him just so he wouldn't be involved because he was giving up splits and like when it wasn't fully getting out there for Luka to be able to turn the corner. So that element of it's looked better, but then it's like you have these two fives out there and Goga's three isn't really falling. So offensively, then they were playing in groupings with like Caris LeVert and McConnell, like I just said. I'm like, I don't really think you need all four of those people out there at the same time. So eventually he kind of fell back out and they went back to now O'Shea Brissett's back, which I think that's a welcome sighting. He's been giving a lot of high energy minutes. He's a very intuitive cutter. He's been shooting the ball a little bit better here of late. So I think that makes more sense from a fit perspective, but then it's like what the whole roster is. Like you can't fully optimize both of your bigs at the same time who are in the starting lineup, let alone 5 minutes for Goga to be playing at the five. And now like, how do you view Isaiah Jackson? Because over the summer, they did indicate that they thought he could play some four, but then when Miles was out against the Timberwolves, when he was out because he was sick, Isaiah Jackson leapfrogged over Goga into the lineup and he was playing at the five. And backup units, which was actually a little bit dicey. I was surprised. His defense, he seemed like positionally he didn't quite know where he wants to be, even though he has really good tools to be able to be like this switchy big and do all these types of things. He seemed a little bit like fish out of water in those sparse minutes. So then the second half, Goga played over him instead. But yeah, I don't really exactly know what Goga's role is going to be unless they are going to move one of these bigs. And even then, you know, either Miles or Sabonis is still going to be there. And it sounds like they want to get minutes for Isaiah Jackson. So then it becomes, how do you really view and want to develop Isaiah Jackson? And I think sometimes if there's a question, if somebody should be a four or five, they should probably be a five. But
I like the theory of what Goga can be, especially if the shot falls down. But like you said, like, I don't know where the minutes come from because you're talking about, I mean, right now, five bigs that you want to find some sort of playing time for. O'Shea Brissett can downsize. Like Torrey Craig can at least play some four for you.
And eventually so, TJ Warren. You're going to want TJ Warren to play small ball four as well. So
it's a bit of a jumbled mess. And one last thing while we're on the bench. Is Justin Holiday the best 3-and-D wing that nobody outside of Indiana talked about?
Justin Holiday is a treasure. I always enjoy him. Like his 3-point shot has been somewhat inconsistent this year. Like it feels like he's either making all the shots or missing all the shots. But like in terms of like role players that I think Pacer fans will remember, he'll be one of them because he's just willing to do so many different things. Like he's punching above his weight class when he tries to guard fours, but he does it. And, you know, he'll take the spot on ball so that Brogdon doesn't have to guard point guards. And it seems like he's been maybe a smidge slower in that role than he was last year, but I think that might be because he started the season with an ankle injury. But yeah, like, and he too has started to develop a little bit better chemistry with Sabonis too, and giving them another movement shooter who they can, you know, play a little bit more random off of each other. And yeah, I think that more people should care and appreciate the great role player that Justin Holiday is.
He's so good. That was the note I was going to make. Like, I don't think I've seen him take a stationary three in like 3 years now. It just feels like he's flying into the corner in transition, or he's flying off of a handoff, or he's relocating somewhere. Like he just has a floor sense about him that I love. And to your point, like I do think he is kind of overtasked defensively sometimes, but he will try. Like someone has to do it, for lack of a better way to phrase it. I love what Justin Holiday brings to the table. I'm surprised that he's on the contract that he's on, honestly. Like I felt like once he hit free agency, someone was going to try to pry him out of there. for a good
bit of money. It's like not enough people paid attention to him or something. I was very surprised when he got the $6 million annual.
It's very well. Like, he's easily a full mid-level guy, in my opinion. But I know Indiana's happy to have him at the price point that they have him at. But I guess, actually, since we briefly mentioned Isaiah Jackson, what flashes have you seen from him offensively this year?
Right. So his season got cut short because he had that, you know, hyperextended his knee against the Raptors, and he wasn't really in the rotation up until that point. And then he played some with the G League and has only played that little, you know, spot minutes up in Minnesota for the most part. But I do think he has a little bit more passing instincts than what people thought. Like, when he was in the summer league, which obviously, you know, summer league is summer league, but they ran high post split cuts, and he did a pretty good job locating where the open man was. Like, even just in comparison to Miles when Miles was at summer league, like, I don't think Miles registered an assist during that entire time. And they ran stuff through Isaiah whenever he came back, because he was out for like the first game. But I think that that's kind of some of an underrated thing. I think his feel is probably better than what people think, but I still think he's somewhat of a lump of clay in what he can be and be developed, and that they're going to have to iron out some of the rough edges before, you know, he's ready to contribute regularly, unless they're going to go to a rebuild and then he's going to be having, you know, minutes opened up for him.
Makes sense. All right, let's cap this off with the mailbag. I just have a few questions for you. A couple of them rolled over from our podcast duo with Mike Prater when we had a Wizards episode. This question was from Aaron, who asked, what tools or websites do you use to watch film?
Okay, so I'm completely not cool, because there's been times where I've like reached out to Synergy and been like, why can't I watch these clips? They don't want to unlock that for me. So mainly it's just like League Pass, but I don't think that's a bad thing, because my recommendation for most people would be, and I don't know what Steve will say, but like, I think watching entire games is more productive than a lot of times just scrolling through clips. Like, if I want to see something quickly that somebody does all the time in that type of action, I might want to do that. But I also want to see what happens when the actions don't work. And, you know, the clip services aren't always going to capture that. Like, you're not going to see like, well, what happens when that guy doesn't shoot off a screen in the corner? How do they counter and what else do they do? So obviously more time consuming to be able to watch the full games, but typically I'm just League Pass.
Okay. I guess we can roll this over. Where were you?
I use my eyes.
Boo. Boo.
No, I will echo what Caitlin said. Watching games will give you more of the pieces you need to learn than just watching clips. And that's no disrespect to watching clips, but you can fall in love and form an opinion pretty quickly with clips. You know, I could go find five or six real quick and make you think Andre Drummond's the best defender in the world. If I put them all together, you might believe me. But if you watch the full game, you might see the subtleties, or maybe when it doesn't work, or those kind of things. You just get more out of watching as much gameplay as you can, even if it's condensed. So I always encourage doing that. But, you know, for me, I'm trying to watch the games using League Pass and trying to see as much as I can, because there's always a story in each game. And the more games you watch, the later in the season, you'll kind of understand and see the differences. You'll notice the tendencies. You'll see what teams are trying to do, what they do when it's winning time, what they do when they're struggling, different rotations, combinations, lineups they go with, all that kind of stuff. You'll kind of be able to fill that in the gap. But then the memory bank. So then when it comes to playoff time, now you see, okay, now this is paying off. Oh, no, this is something they try to do all the time. You know, even a little thing like the Phoenix Suns running a playoff tip-offs. The more games you watch, you notice that. Like, oh, this is the thing. You know, or you see, oh, Memphis is playing different now. Just those kind of things. So, yeah, I'm anti-clip guy.
Okay.
I've seen it firsthand where, I'm not going to go too deep into it, it'll be a tease, but there was a draft meeting where clips were shown of a certain player that almost changed the perspective of everything. And that's the moment I was like, okay, enough. No more clips.
Okay. We're going to have to get into this on a different episode.
The player was Royce White.
Well then, I guess we can leave that there. Oh, goodness. This one comes from my good friend, PD Webb, friend of the show. That's, what have been some of the trendy play calls or actions of the early season for you?
Me first?
Yes.
So to shout out Evan Gualberto and Samson Folk, who do the bouncing around YouTube show.
It's fantastic. They
love to talk about Garfunkels, which is
thank you.
Yes, we need to shout that out. So it's basically a ghosted ball screen into Veer. Like Veer is a ball screen into a pin down, but they call it a Garfunkel if you ghost the ball screen and go into the pin down. So I feel like a lot of teams are not just like that's a common action, but are doing different things to disguise it before they get to that so that they can surprise teams with the pin down. I see a lot of teams doing that. One example I would give is like, you know, you might pair it with a 45 cut so that when the big is going to Veer, that player cuts out at the 45 and then they're getting the guy in the corner. So you don't quite know which one of those two shooters is going to come off. And just different ways to get to that. The Pacers have a lot of different Veer plays that they run, but so do a lot of different teams. I also have seen a lot of teams use UCLA reject, where they set up like they're going to run a UCLA cut, and then that shifts the defense to one side of the floor, and then they fire it to the other side into various different actions. Phoenix has done that. The Raptors do that. I've seen them, well, the Magic under Steve Clifford last year did it. I haven't seen a lot of the Magic this year, but those are two just like nerdy things that I've seen.
Okay. And that is a great transition to the next question. Outside of Indiana, which I'm not sure how enjoyable that's been for you this season, but what are some non-Indy teams that you've enjoyed watching this year?
So I think we'll probably be simpatico on this, because even when the Nuggets are down bad, I still enjoy watching Nikola Jokic play, because like just my overall writing style, I like to watch things that are very like, you know, something that people might not pick up on, where it's a tiny read and he's like a supercomputer. So like I was doing a show with some people that cover the Nuggets, and I was watching some of their games leading up to it. And I'm like, oh wow, they're running like option screens for Jokic, and he would fake off of it and then curl back in and set a screen for somebody else to pop out. And it was all just a read. Like most of what he does is just so read based, and he alters and does stuff. So even with their players out, I typically like when the Pacers are off, I'll look like, are the Nuggets playing a West Coast game? I'm probably going to turn that on. So,
love the Nuggets. Steve, did you have something you want to jump in with the Denver Nuggets? Oh, goodness.
I do. Nope, okay. I do.
Okay.
Nikias.
Yes.
You stated that Nikola Jokic, reigning MVP, tremendous, tremendous, unbelievable talent. Oh,
we're getting caveats. This is great. Go ahead.
Is the best offensive big man of all time. And I considered not showing up tonight after you said that. But out of respect for the dunkers, out of respect for Caitlin, I'm going to give you the opportunity to say some words.
Say some words.
To help me understand how that happened.
Well, I saw a tweet this morning who asked if Jokic was the best offensive big man of all time. And my answer, I think, was probably yeah, was my exact answer.
This Dolph Shays slander?
yes, it is, actually. I finally get to grind my axe on Dolph. But no, in all seriousness, like, I think it's an interesting discussion. Because what we've seen over the last couple of years from Nikola Jokic as a scorer, like the blend of him being able to do so on all three levels, obviously can get it done from the mid post, can knock down threes, can post up, can face up, whatever. Can score on all three levels, can shoot. And the passing is the best I've seen. And so I think combining the scoring versatility that he has on top of the playmaking, and it's not even of the, it's not even of the Rondo variety where he's only making passes for assist and kind of halting your offense that way. Like it's very, like Caitlin said, it's very rebased what he does. Like I think the blend of scoring, shooting, and passing, it puts him up there. Like I don't think Jokic is the best scorer of all time at the center position. You can make your arguments for Shaq or Hakeem or Kareem, who's the all-time leading scorer. Like if you want to say Jokic isn't the best scorer ever, like fine, I'm not even going to argue that. But I think the blend of that plus him being, I think, the best passing big man of all time is where I'm like, okay, if we're encompassing all of offense, like I think he has a strong case for it.
You said Jokic was rather easily the best passing big man of all time, and that offended me because of Arvydas Sabonis did exist.
I'm sorry to offend.
How much better is Jokic than Dirk?
Offensively? I just think the passing separates it.
He's very complete. I agree with you. I wouldn't say that he's one of the greatest scoring big men of all time. I wouldn't say that he's the best offensive big man ever either, but I do think he's extremely complete.
There we go. What a respectful way to disagree. Steve's just ready to throw me off the podcast.
No, he's insane. So I don't want to not act like he's not. Like, man, he just took over a whole game against the Pelicans. And what he does on a nightly basis is incredible. The way he scores, like, he doesn't get enough respect for that. So I understand what you're saying. But the best offensive big of all time, like, George Mikan happened.
Okay. This is I'm going to bed.
Oh, have you done the Jokic drill?
Jesus Christ. All right. Caitlin, what is your biggest NBA pet peeve?
Okay, so, well, one of them might have been last night when Evan Fournier took a take foul when the Knicks had four defenders back, but let's leave that aside. And say that it actually has, like, nothing to do with basketball per se, or like actual like rules and the operation of basketball. As far as jump ball tosses, drive me crazy. Like, I think we need to have a school for how to throw that. And also, can we just get the players to just stand in their spot and just freaking throw the ball up? Like, why is it take? It's like watching the Kentucky Derby when we're like all getting in the gates and people are going wild. It's like, it would just stand there and let them throw the ball.
I think my favorite is when they are on the wrong side and then they flip over two times and they're still in the wrong spot and then they just kind of keep moving around.
Or when they try to sneak in somebody else, like, oh, if they don't notice that this person wasn't really there. And then it's just all further delay of game. Yep. It's the entire jump ball experience.
Also, I love that the jump ball toss has to be egregiously bad for them to restart it. And then if you ever watch, the ref who tossed the ball is mad offended. Whenever that happens, won't look at anybody, won't talk to anybody, just takes the ball and gets right back to his spot. It's hilarious every time.
Throws the ball up even quicker.
That's even more reason to call them out for the egregious errors so that we can watch that in real time.
There you go. Like, I think we had a similar question on Basketball News when he pulled a bunch of outriders. Like, what's the pit fee? I hate the dead ball after a shot clock violation. When the defense recovers the ball, like, just let them run in transit. Like, you're helping the offense after they weren't able to get a shot up. Like, I could understand if it's a loose ball of some sort after the buzzer sounds and you want to blow it dead after they get it. But if it's just if it's an air ball and they catch it, like, let the transition opportunity happen. Like, I can't stand it. Steve, what about you? Outside of my takes.
When they call the delay of game, if a player accidentally, it just happens to be there and catches the ball and hands it to the ref, they don't do it as much as they used to, but that drives me up the wall. Players begging for reviews, that's climbing up there for me. Especially early in the game, because they're not going to do it. And then the secondary part is when the coach buckles because of who did it.
Yeah, the vanity review. It's totally a vanity review. It's like, oh, we got to stay good with that guy. So we'll go ahead and challenge this thing that really is inconsequential.
And, like, Giannis will call for a review and then he'll be right. But then, like, a play will come right after that needs to be reviewed. You can't review it now. So what have you accomplished? But those are my pet peeves right now. I probably have more, but.
You have to have more.
Give me 2 seconds. Well, actually, no. You know what? Guards who can't snake properly in pick and roll.
Ah.
And destroy plays.
Redacted slander out in Houston, I see.
Stop doing that. Please. If you come off the screen and you're supposed to come off the screen and read the defense, don't immediately come back to where you were and try and hold your man off. And it doesn't work and no one does anything. Also, post-entry passes.
Yes.
I've watched Philadelia entirely too much this week, and they can't do it. And it drives me insane. They're trying to do it from half court, staring at the person, putting the ball right here in front of their face. I'm like, how can no one do a post-entry pass? Now, Nekias, you got me riled up, and you just want me to sound old and musty. But I'll keep going. You know what? Bad slip screens. I don't like those either. If you're going to slip, do it. don't just stand there and then like just not screen at all. And just like, there's no, you didn't fake anyone out. Stop pump faking air.
Well, go on. You got more. It's fine.
Nah, I'm surprised you didn't talk about rhythm dribbles.
Oh my God.
Yes. Why do you get mad at rhythm dribbles? Like if Steph Curry takes a rhythm dribble, what are you going to say? Good shot.
He just missed one. Yeah, if it goes in, I don't know. Like I want to say it's mostly an aesthetic thing for me. Like I don't like the slow build. It just looks worse when there's some awful defensive miscue, or if it's just you scramble the defense, it's a swing, you get a wide open corner shot, and then you just stare at it. And like no one closes out because they know they're beat. And you just stare at it and you dribble and you look at the rim and you know, you say hi to your mom in the crowd and you take the shot and it cleans off the back of the rim. It's just like, what was any of that for? Disrupted rhythm because you're surprised that the shot was open. Like, stay ready so you don't have to get ready. It's kind of where I'm at with that. But I don't know. Like, that just, it bugs me, especially when good shooters do it. It's just weird.
Timeouts when the game is out of hand.
Yes.
Stop calling those. You're down 7 with 30 seconds left. I understand. But no.
Here's a good example of one. The other night, the Pacers, when they were playing the Wizards, took Sabonis out with like a minute and 30 left to play, put Miles in, which I'm like, can Goga not even get a victory cigar here? Put Miles in, and Miles like made, I don't even really care, like some defensive mistake when they're already going to win. And they put Sabonis back in with 30 seconds to play. Why? Like, why are you going to risk that injury? And like, don't do that to Miles. Like, we all saw the mistake. Just let him finish it out at this point.
I'm not a fan of that. Well, I don't like the petty substitutions at the end of games. Like, I think down 7 with 30 seconds left. Like, this is the anniversary of the T-Mac thing. So, like, I fundamentally have to reject that premise because that is incredible what he was able to do against San Antonio. But yeah, I'm kind of with you. Like, let the clock run out. I don't like when the game is clearly out of hand. And it's like 26 seconds left. You got a full 24. Like, just let the game run out. We don't need to. The team is just dribbling the clock out. It's a shot clock violation with 2 seconds left. We don't have to have that. No one gets, it's not recorded for any specific player anyway. Like, just let the 26 go out at that point. So there we go. We have timeout minutia. We have rhythm dribbles. Steve just reeled off like 8 of his hate takes. I'm very proud of him. We're going to get more. We're going to have a pet peeve episode at some point. I feel like you have more in the chamber. But Caitlin, where can the people find you?
All right. So my handle's at C2_Cooper. And then I'm at Indie Cornrows. It's the Pacers blog at SB Nation.
There we go. Follow all of her work. Listen to the podcast. She is tremendous at what she does. We're, again, very thankful that you were able to come on with us tonight. Thank you all for listening to this episode of Dunker Spot. Please rate, review, and subscribe if you have not already. We're on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your pods. You can find us. You can find me on Twitter at NikaiasNBA. You can find Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.
Utah Jazz fans are tired of hearing about Rudy Gobert not being able to play defense.